My apologies for the mess with the exercises, but I think we might have figured it out now. Lots of you said that they can't do on Thursday either. So what we decided to do is to keep the Friday date, right? Because the majority of you guys already committed to it. And in addition to that, since a lot of other people could show up also on Thursday, we will offer a second exercise date on Thursday from 12 to 2. Okay. This doesn't work out for you either?
No, I have from 12 to 2 elementary in America.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. But we still have the one on Friday. Yeah. It's difficult to make everyone happy. Sorry about that. But the offer still stands with the. Okay, so just to have a quick head count, who is able to go to the Thursday session? Just one person. 12 to 2.
We all have a number.
Okay, that's interesting. Where are the people who said that they would be available on Thursday as well?
Maybe they are not here today, so
okay.
Sunday from 2:15. From 2 to 3:30. Yeah, that would be possible.
Okay.
Some late o'clock would be possible from 2 to 4.
Okay. Thursday 2 to 4.
Yeah, that would be possible for the most of us.
Okay. Thursday 2 to 4. All right. Okay. So Thursday 2 to 4 and Friday 2 to 4. Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. Perfect. In other news, the exercises will be skipped this week.
Yes.
Okay.
So we decided now from Thursday and Friday from 2 to 4.
I have to check with my colleagues if they are available from 2 to 4, but
can
should
you
be
send an email?
Absolutely. Okay. Perfect.
Are you going to fix the deadline for your assignment?
No.
No?
Not yet. I don't know what Shima told you last Friday.
She said she's going to tell.
She's going to tell, yeah. So not yet, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And we will also... So the next exercise will be about the basics of Linux, okay? Since most of you or quite a few people said that they are not so familiar with Linux and how to use the command line, etc., we will have the next exercise as an introduction to how to use the Linux shell. Okay, next week. Yeah. No. What's up? Okay, that's not supposed to happen. Okay, so you all got an email from the HPC support that your accounts are available now? Nope. Okay.
I got an account, but I didn't get an email, so it seems like I don't send emails.
Okay. Okay, so you all should have an account by now. If you log on to IDM, if you log on to IDM somehow, it should be, you should. Under your services, you should have the service package HPC. So it's somewhere other services and then special services. Here you go. You should have the service package HPC, where you have a username that's different from your IDM account name. Okay, and you can set password, etc. here in this IDM portal. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, then your account probably isn't activated yet. Did you send me an email? So one person sent me an email that they registered late. So if you don't have it in your IDM, please send me an email with your IDM name so we can activate the account there as well. Okay.
Sorry, so what that
is
used for?
For the exercises. So this is access to the HPC resources we have here in Erlangen. It's a small 560 node cluster where you have access to, where you can run your code and experiment with it. Okay. One small announcement here. You are not supposed to do any Bitcoin mining or anything like that, okay? The timeshare that we got for it is very limited, so please don't exhaust it. Please don't just for fun, you know? Please use it responsibly. Right, so the accounts will be deactivated at the end of the semester. Okay.
March,
end of March. Okay, so if you have any if you put any data there, make sure that you copy it back at the end of the semester if you want to somehow keep it. Okay. Great. We will go through how to use the system in the exercises as well. Okay. Right. So just so you know. Okay. Right. It's probably now creeping. Okay. Any questions regarding that?
You said we have 2 weeks for the exercise, and last week the exercise started, so we are
There's no deadline yet.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, any other questions still regarding the organizational matters? No, not yet. They will be planned once everyone registered in Mein Campus. Okay, I think the registration opens
7th of November.
No.
But and all the other exams are already have a date.
Okay. Possible. I'm still new to the written exam game, so I don't know. So the other lectures probably put some preferences of the last years in, and that's why. No.
Do you know which week or?
No. But I will let you know as soon as I know. Okay.
Is it written exam or the oral exam?
Written exam for most of you. I think there's a group of mathematicians here, and you're required to have the oral exam, right?
I think so.
No. Okay. Perfect. Any other questions? So for the oral exam group, we just make appointments whenever you feel like it, and when I have time as well. Okay. Whenever you feel comfortable, we can discuss it. Whenever. Okay. Yeah.
Are the exercise, both exercises, going to be same because Shema said that?
Yes.
She's going to divide according to our background.
Well, that's I told her that's not not feasible because not everyone's available at the specific. So those of you who are so it's going to be a stretch, right? For the group of people that's already very knowledgeable and knows how to program, knows how to use the system, they have to be patient with the rest of the group who just isn't as experienced yet. Okay.
Yeah, also, I'm concerned my different state test is nothing.
Yeah. Okay. We will try our best to account for that.
Okay.
But it's always a little difficult for us. Okay. All right. Okay. If there are no questions left, we can get back to the content. All right. So I think this was the last slide that we discussed last time. So the cache replacement problem. All right. And in general, when looking at the caches, the classification of misses is that we have three different misses. The first is the compulsory miss, right? The one that you can't avoid when you first access a block. It does not. It obviously does not hit the cache, so it has to be loaded for the first time. Okay. The second is the capacity miss, right? When you're set. In your associative caching is full, you have a capacity miss, right? That's only for associative caches, right? A conflict miss is if you don't have a full if you don't have an associative placement strategy, you might get a conflict with the direct mapping, for example. Okay, so those are the three misses. Okay. Right. So let's dive into an example. Okay. I hope you still have the caching at the back of your mind, or do you want to have a quick repetition? No? No? Okay. So the example is that we have two matrices, A and B. Okay, they have the dimension 64 by 64. Okay, each element is single precision floating point. Okay, who knows how much, how many bytes a single precision floating point has? So,
Eight.
No, it's 4 byte. Okay. Double precision is 8 byte. Okay. Okay. It's a row major memory layout. Can anybody? Does anyone know what this means?
Well, the elements of the matrix are considered in lines, not in columns.
Okay, let's draw a picture. Okay, we have our matrix, right? We have the rows and the columns. Okay, in the computer, in the memory, we only have a linear memory space, right? So we don't have any two-dimensional kind of thing. So what we need to do is we somehow need to store the elements of the matrix, right? And so for dense matrices, so where almost every entry is non-zero. We usually have the choice between row major, what's called row major, and column major. Okay. So row major means, as you said, the rows are stored. So when we look at the memory, what we have is that we have one big linear chunk of memory. Okay. And at the very start, we have the first row, right? Then we have the, so this is 0.0. Then we have the second row at the end of the first row, right? Which is then 0.1, and so on and so forth, right? So when we want to iterate over the elements of this matrix, right, in row major order, that means row by row by row, we can just linearly iterate over this linear segment of memory, right? If it would be column major, it would mean that we store one column as one continuous block of memory. Okay. So for our example, this means that when A is located at address 0x1000, right, hexadecimal, that means that for the A matrix, the first element of the first row is stored at 0x1000, okay, and the first element of the second row is stored at the element 0x1010, right? Right? Yeah. No, of course not. This one, it's 256. Okay, and so on, right? So we just add 100 there, right? Because we have 4-byte elements, right? 4 times 64 is 256, and 100 is 256 in hexadecimal. Okay? So that's how the elements are stored. For the matrix B, it's similar, right? So we start at 4,000 and then move on. Okay? So far, so good. So what we want to do with those matrices is we want to calculate something, right? So we just sum up the some elements of matrix A and multiply it by a constant factor. Okay. Just a very simple example. So the center, one above, one below, left and right. Okay. So for the cache, we have a 16-byte cache line. Okay. That means that we can store 4 elements in one cache line, okay? And the cache size is 256 bytes. We have 32-bit addresses and the word size is 1 byte, okay? And as a replacement strategy, we just choose the least recently used strategy, okay? And what we want to do with this example is to compare the different placement strategies. So full associative versus direct mapping versus two-way set associative. Okay, and for that purpose, we want to go through through updating the element B14 and B15. Okay, so use that code for y equals 1 and x equals 4. Okay.
This cache layout is a fixed configuration, or it could vary.
It's just an example. Yeah. So it's not any, well, it might be any reprocessor, but it's not. It's just an example to illustrate you the caches once more. Okay, and yeah.
Can you please explain how you name those again?
This one?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the address where the rows start. Okay. So we say that A is located here and B is located here, right? And we have 64 elements here. So from 0 to 64, okay? Each element is single precision floating point, okay? Which means that it's 4 byte, okay? That means that one row needs the space of, we have 64 elements, sorry, 63. We have 64 elements. Each element has 4 bytes, right? That means that we have, that in order to store, we need a space of 265, 56 bytes, right? And 256 is in hexadecimal 100, right? So we have 0 times 16 to the power of 0 plus 0 times 16 to the power of 1 for that one here, and 1 times 16 to the power of 2, right? And that's right. And so we just add the amount of space we need for one row to get to the first element of the next row.
So the rows are just stacked on the side?
They are just stick together. Okay. So incidentally, since this is a square matrix, right, if we would have chosen a column matrix layout, then the first column would start at this address. The second column would start at this address, etc. Right? Okay. Okay. So, for the purpose of illustration, we only since we only care about the cache, the instructions that I listed here are just the memory operations, right? The load operations and the store operations. So if we want to update B14, right, we need to have the sender element of A, the upper element of A, one below, one up, one below, one left, and one right. Okay? And those are the addresses for this, right? So we have the first row, okay, and the third element. So the first row is starts at 1100, right? And then we have the third element, right? 3 times 4 is 12, and that's the C. Okay. And then it continues, right? Okay.
If we have a system, how can we find the addresses where matrix A and B are stored? Or is that just for the example we say that A's are stored there?
This is just for the example. If you want to find the address, so let's. So it's actually, I mean. So live programming is always hard, right? Okay. So if we come, so right. So we can just have one variable, right? Is it readable for everyone?
Yeah.
Okay, I can increase it once more. Okay, so, and obviously for that we don't know the address, right?
Yeah.
So what we can do, however, is we in C and C++ we can take the address, right, and print it out. Okay. So if we execute it, okay, we get the address here. Okay, this is just some arbitrary address. Okay, if we have if you want to create our matrix, right? We create our storage, which can hold the matrix, right? Vector, std vector is the C++ class for dynamic memory stuff. And we allocate 64 times 64 elements, right, for our row major order. Okay. And what we can then do now is something like this. Okay. Let's take the address here. Okay. So we get. What's going on? So we get another another address here. Okay. No one's screaming. No one's complaining. Everything's good. So, question is, did we really take? Are you kidding me? So if we look at this address here. Okay. If we look at this address that we got here, right? If you look at it closely, you can see that it's 4 bytes. So we have the integer, which is 4 bytes on the system, and plus 4 bytes is then our vector, right? So question is this really the address of our memory? Probably not, right? Because this is on the stack, right? So we messed it up. Okay, so. What we did there is we took the address of this vector class. Okay, vector is a class, right? So it looks a little bit like from the layout, it looks a little bit like this. Okay. Very, 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 very briefly. So, where we also have the size. Okay. So, if we have a class like this, right, and we just declare define a variable like this for a class that's looking approximately like this, right? We only get the pointer that's pointing to the struct, right? But what we want to have instead is the pointer to the data, right? So and the data, this pointer is dynamically allocated, right? So we can call the data member function on the vector. And we get a completely different address, right? Which now points to our 64 by 64 matrix. Okay. The first element. So the you might already see a problem there, right? It's not really aligned to cache lines or anything, right? So but it will still work. And in practice, it's not really important at which exact address the elements are, right? That's not really that important. The importance is important is since you always iterate or work on sufficiently large sufficiently large data set for code like this update code, you usually can assume that that the behavior in the limit is something like okay, you get this and this many misses and this many hits, etc. Right? So it's not really that important where exactly it starts and ends. It's just to give to get a feeling of where cache misses might appear. Right? Okay. Okay. So this is so. Yeah, and in practice, you really don't need to worry about how the memory allocation is done, or most of the time, you don't really need to worry how the memory allocation is done, and where the stuff is actually created. Okay, so you usually don't deal with addresses. Okay, so if I would write something like float B, so a pointer to B, right? And say it's located at this address, as in the example. Okay, this is actually not allowed, right? You can't just assign numbers to pointers. Okay, and this will actually segfault, hopefully. And it doesn't even compile. So, yeah. Okay. You can force it. And then you get a segmentation fault, right? That usually means that you accessed some invalid memory address. Okay. All right. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. All right. So let's start with the caching. So the first thing that we want to look at is the fully associative cache. Okay. We to get back to it, we have a cache line of 16 byte, word size of 1 byte, and cache size of 256 bytes. Right. That means that each cache block has 16 bytes, right? So our word index is 4-bit, right? To address 16 elements, we need 4 bits, okay? And our set in the fully associative case is, of course, 0-bit, and our tag is then 28-bit, okay? If we go through the instructions, what we see here, of course, if we execute the first instruction, our cache is completely empty. So what we get here is a miss, right? Which kind of miss?
Compulsory.
A compulsory miss, exactly. No. And right, so we have our tag where we just cut off the word, right, and put it into the tag. The next access is a miss again, right? Different tag that we had before. So again, a compulsory miss. And this continues until we hit the A14 element, which is already in the cache, right? We have the tag 111. It's in the third element, right? So we can access it from the cache. All right. So when we want to store the result to the element in the matrix B, we of course get another compulsory miss, right? Different tag, so we can just place it into the cache. Okay. So then we move on with the element A14, right, which is also in the cache, and 05 is in the cache as well as 16, right? So in this example, we only got compulsory misses, which is as good as it can get, right? So perfect. Questions? Okay. So the next is the direct mapping cache. Okay. We need 8 sets. Okay. So in order to get to 8 sets, we need our set bit is 3 bit, right? And our word still remains 4 bit. That won't change, and our tag is now 25 bits. Okay. So if we execute the first load instruction, right, we end up in set 0, right? That's the first 3 bits after the word bit, and the remaining is the tag bit, right? So we get a compulsory miss. If we execute the next instruction, we have the tag of 1, right, which is great. We don't have any. We didn't have anything in the second set, so we can just store the cache block in there. Now, executing the next instruction, we also have the tag 1, right? Unfortunately, the tags didn't match, right? So we have a conflict miss, and we have to evict the cache line, right, that we stored previously. And this pattern continues now, right? Tag 1, another miss, another miss, another miss, and so on until the very end. Okay, so that was pretty bad. Okay, so that's just how to illustrate how bad direct mapping could be. Okay.
Can you just explain the difference between set and block? Because in previous example we have a different block from 0 to 7. Here we have set from 0 to 7.
Okay.
What's the difference?
If we go back to our K-way associative mapping. Okay.
Yeah. So it's kind of K blocks for some line.
Yeah. So the block would be the block in the associative set. Okay. And in the direct mapping case, we don't have. We don't have blocks, so it's always 0. Okay. All right. So. A little confusing, yeah. Okay, so let's look at the two-way associative cache. Okay, two-way associative cache means that we have two blocks in our set, right? And so we have 4 sets for this example. Okay, so we need 2 bits for the set. Again, 4 bits for the word, and then we have 26 bits for the tag. Okay, so the first load has the tag 44, and it's in the set 0, right? The next one is in the set 1, right? And we store the tag and the cache line, right? The next one is again in the set 1, right? And we still have one entry left, so we can store it inside there, right? Then we have the next load, right? Again, tag 1, right? But our set is full. Which kind of miss do we get? Capacity miss, right? Okay, and then we need to evict the item that has been least recently used. Okay, and in that case, it's that one over there, right? It's not least recently used over all elements, obviously, but just within the set. Okay. And for the next load, we then have a hit in the set one and block one, right? So where we have the same tag already in the cache. Okay, and when we want to store, well, we have a capacity miss again, and we have to get to evict the least recently used item. Okay, why? I think I messed up here. No, I did not.
The first one was already deleted.
Yeah, no, we least recently used this item here.
Okay. Right?
And now we evicted. Right, that shouldn't happen. Okay. And yeah, the remaining ones are capacity misses again, where we just replaced the least recently used. And eventually we hit another entry that's already in the cache. Okay? Questions? So you see that the two-way associative cache is a little bit better than the direct mapping, right? If we increase the set sizes, the number of blocks inside a set, it will get better, obviously, right? So I think most modern processors have something like a 8-way associative cache. Okay, and depending on the level of the cache, it's ranging from 32 megabytes, so in total cache capacity from 32 megabytes to a few hundred kilobytes, right? So there is sufficient room, and if you write algorithms like this correctly, you won't get a lot of cache misses. Okay, writing it correctly with the caches in mind is sometimes difficult, but doable. Okay. Right. So that's the last slide for caching. Do you have any questions? No. Okay. Then we move on to the next topic. The next topic, which is important for the for us at least, with respect to supercomputers, is vectorization. Okay, so it's again a optimization for the instruction set that we have. So when we look at what we can do with simple instructions, what we had so far is that we just add to numbers and store it to a result, right? And if we talk about vector operations, well, what we could do instead is adding a bunch of numbers together and store them in a vector again, right? So this is almost all supercomputers actually do have some kind of vector instruction, right? And for that purpose, the instruction set offers special vector instructions where you can do, for example, add 8 floating point elements together in one instruction, which is as fast as if you would add a single element together, right? So this is how you get how you easily get parallelism by using those vector instructions. Okay. So,
but the vectors have to be big enough or small enough to, that the caches can store them or not. Because otherwise it wouldn't be as fast as a Scala operation.
Good point. Yep. Very good point. Excellent. So you say the vectors here need to be the right size. So they can't be too big,
yeah,
right? Because if they are bigger than a cache line, then
they have to be in the memory or they have to be cut. And so we have to be able to store them.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point. So let's illustrate that point real quick. Most of the time, most processors have a 64 byte cache line. Okay, nowadays. Okay. 64 byte cache line means for floating point we can store 16 floating points in there, right? 16 floating points. Yeah. All right. So we can store 16 floats. Okay, single precision floats. Okay. Now if we look at the vector instructions, the latest incarnation of the Intel processors have 512 bytes of vector instructions. So one vector is able to store 512 bytes. Okay. Yeah, which is a little bit bigger than, it's four times bigger than one cache line, right? Spatial locality, right? Spatial locality helps there. So spatial locality helps there, definitely. And of course, in that case, we have to fetch four cache lines. Yeah?
You mean 512
bit? Bit, yeah. 512 bit, I was wondering here. So 512 bit is 64 bytes again. No, I'm stupid now. 64 bytes, yeah, sorry about that, thanks. So 64 byte. Okay, so now, if it's in the cache, it's all good, right?
Yes.
It's as fast. But if it's not in the cache, well, if it's so the other problem is if we have if you want to operate on a vector and load it from memory, right? If it's not aligned to a cache line, that means we have to do two loads, right? So that's the potential cost there. Yeah. But in general, it's so the instruction itself, once it's in a register, it's as fast as the scalar instructions. Okay.
Could you explain about this vector? I understood the 64 bit cache line.
Yeah.
But I didn't understand the 512 bit. What it represents or what is it used for?
So, if we look at the vector instructions, right, we need some registers to hold the data, right? So, and in the latest Intel processor generation, we have the space available in one vector register is 512 bit, right? So, in 512 bit, we can store 64 bytes of memory, right, or 16 floating points. Single precision floating points. Okay, just an example there. Okay. Yeah, but good intuition that you immediately noticed it. Yeah. So perfect. Right. Nevertheless, since we can argue that we most of the time have a spatial locality, at least for most numerical codes, we can assume that we can fetch the elements of the vector in, from one cache line. Right. And some architectures even disallow the loading of unaligned memory. Okay. So they completely avoid this problem by just not allowing it. Okay. So you will get a segmentation fault if you try to load a non-64 byte aligned from an address that's not 64 byte aligned into a vector register, you get a seg fault on some architectures. Okay. Okay. So the question then is, well, yeah, how big to choose the vector sizes, right? So vector instructions in general really don't necessarily need to be of fixed size. Okay. So in general, we can say that the vector registers are able to hold up to n vector elements. Okay. And the vector instruction is then performing the vector operation, right? And the advantage of this general formulation here is that we don't necessarily always need to execute all 16 operations, right? So there are architectures where you can say, okay, I just say I have five elements and I want to do a vector operation on those five elements, that's entirely possible, right? So you don't necessarily have a fixed vector width for the vector instructions. The exception here is the what we call SIMD. So SIMD stands for single instruction multiple data, right? Which is the most popular implementation of vector instructions these days, right? Where you really have a fixed size for each generation of vector instructions, you have a fixed size of elements you have in your code, and yeah, that also means that if you program against a certain version, certain flavor of SIMD instructions, and want to port it to a different machine, yeah, you have to use the different instructions, different vector sizes, right? So, but if you have vector instructions that are actually independent of the actual length of the vector registers, you can very easily parallelize your code using those vector instructions, right? And possible implementations are that you either have parallel ALUs or pipelined ALUs or even both, right? So just to be able to perform a bunch of operations in parallel. Okay? So, right. And as I mentioned, the other flavor is the single instruction multiple data. That's what you have in Intel CPUs, ARM CPUs, power CPUs, almost any CPU that's available. You have single instruction multiple data, but there is movement to switch back to the real vector instructions, where you have the independence of the actual length of the vector registers, right? The reason why most vendors chose the SIMD approach is because it looks easy, right? It's the easy way out of the problem to add those instructions. And for that, I can recommend a article, SIMD instructions considered harmful. It's a very nice article going a little bit more in depth into the topic of vectorization by some example, and look at the different approaches and compare fixed length SIMD instructions versus the real deal of dynamic length vector instructions. Okay, this is a very, very nice article. I can upload it to Stodon as well if you're interested.
Yes.
Okay. So perfect. Right. Okay. Any questions regarding the vectorization? So one quick remark there. If you look at GPUs, so the architecture of a GPU, which we will dive into deeper as well in the future sessions. If you look at those architectures, they are not SIMD architectures. They are more like the dynamic length vector computers. Right? They call it differently. They call it SIMT, but it's essentially a big vector computer. Okay? So just as a remark. And the ARM processors are trying to catch up with the real vector instructions as well as the RISC-V architecture. Okay, just as a side remark. Okay. The article that I just showed you is actually from the principal designer of the RISC architecture. So, yeah. Okay. So with that, we have, yeah?
A question. What's actually the benefit of having a variable length of my vector instruction? Because I actually want a fixed length in order to be able to fix problems like, yeah, my cache line is 64 bytes and I have to have the equivalent amount of data there to actually use AVX because the limit is getting the data in there. So why? What's the benefit of having this variable?
The benefit is you don't. So if you have your fixed size width, right, you usually have something like, let's deal with the unaligned elements first, then have a loop over the aligned elements with the vector instructions, and then have a remainder loop for the rest that's still not aligned, right? So that's the general approach, right? If you have dynamic length, right, you can just say, just put it in there and do the vector operation and be done with it, right? And the big advantage there is that the actual hardware implementation can do whatever it wants, right? You say, I want to sum up 128 floating point vectors, okay, vector elements. That's fine. Do however you wish. Right, and then the hardware can actually figure out. Okay, then the hardware can do the peeling of the unaligned loads first. In parallel, do the aligned vector instructions, and the actual implementation, of course, has to be fixed sized again. Right, but then the hardware has more decisions on how to schedule the different operations. So the and that's actually pretty nicely. There's a pretty nice discussion about this very topic here. So in this article. So
it's in there, just read that.
Yeah, just read it.
Okay.
Right. So the amount of instructions required for the MIPS architecture here is 3,000. For AVX2, it's 1,500. And for the vector extension for the RISC-V, it's 163. Okay, if you take a perform this operation with 1,000 elements. Okay.
Instructions because we need some kind of at some point we have to match the fixed size because we have an LED dealing with a fixed size and has to calculate. So does this actually mean we just have more micro instructions? We have to make the set at some point.
Yeah. It usually means that you have more microinstructions. Yeah. So here's the assembly for the vector code, okay? Where we just say, okay, we can store 8 where we just do this vector addition here, right? And so we load the vector x. We increase the size, right? And we just load the vector and do the vector operation, right? And the x86 instruction is this. This is MIPS as well again. Well, just read through it. It's pretty well explained why the approach of dynamic length vectors is actually beneficial, especially for the programmer. Right. Okay, any other questions? Okay. So, in order to continue and to classify our systems, what I want to discuss next is to actually give you a tool or a model to classify first of all your computing system, and second of all how your application performs within the limitations or capabilities of the systems. Right. So every current computing system has, of course, caches, pipelined ALUs, superscalar pipelines, branch prediction, out-of-order execution. So it's a whole bunch of stuff that interferes with your application when it runs on the specific architecture, right? And it's almost close to impossible to for any non-trivial program to predict at a very high precision how well this code performs, right? Or to say exactly what's happening in the CPU core, right? And it gets even worse when we go from single core to multi-core processors, and even worse when we go from homogeneous to heterogeneous processors. The problem there is we just don't we cannot comprehend all the different inferences that might occur when running a program, right? So the goal for the remainder of this lecture will be to discuss the roofline model, right, which has the goal to provide a very simple model to actually look at your code and to classify your code and tell you what's good or bad. Okay, so it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to reduce the complexity of the modern multi-core architectures, right? It has to be easy to understand so that everyone can apply it very quickly, right? And we just need something to work with, right? And so the unit for the performance model is usually some application-specific performance metric, right? If you are into computer games, you usually have a very good metric. That's the frames per second, right? If you don't have 60 frames per second, well, then better buy a new hardware, right? To get the or reduce the settings. And in the field of high-performance computing, it's usually floating point operations per second, right? How many mass operations can we achieve in a single second, right? So other possibilities is the bandwidth, right? Or similar to the frames per second, some updates per second, right? So matrix elements per second, or you name it, right? Mostly to communicate whether the performance improvements you made actually have an impact on the science you want to do, right? So if you, for example, have a weather simulation, right? And I'm the engineer who is going to optimize your weather application, and I will hack on the code, and then 2 weeks later I will come back to you and say, I was able to improve the performance of your code by 100 gigaflops. Okay, that's almost meaningless, right? But if I go to you and say, hey, I was able to improve the performance of your code by 100, grid elements per second, right? Then that's better, because this means to you that, okay, now I'm able to, in the same amount of time, I'm able to increase the resolution of my problem, because I'm now able to execute more grid elements per second, right? So the metric is always depends on the on who you communicate with. Okay, most of the time we are speaking about gigaflops here, because we don't have any specific applications, and that's or bandwidth, because that's the most generic performance metric that we have. Okay. All right. So. Of course, there are other models, right? So there are analytical models, statistical performance models, and the advantage of the analytical model is that they really are pretty precise usually, right? But they are usually difficult to manage and difficult to handle. Right? You need to know a lot of detail about your application, about your computer architecture, and so on and so forth, right? And the alternative to that is so-called bound and bottleneck models, right? So going back to the metrics that we want to look at, right, is the gigaflops and the bandwidth, where we have two upper bounds of our performance. One is the amount of floating point operations that we can actually perform in a given time period, theoretically. And the actual bandwidth that we can get out of our memory system, right? This is the upper bound, and the bottleneck is then identify in which region we are. So are we either bandwidth bound, compute bound, which then determines the bottleneck of our code. Right, and that's essentially what the roofline model is. Okay, so the roofline is a simple two-dimensional model, and the main bottleneck in today's systems, as I stressed quite prominently already, is of course the memory bandwidth. Okay, so what we want to have is a relationship between the processor performance, which is the numerical operations per second, and the memory traffic, right? And the value that we are going to look at is the operational intensity, right? That means the number of operations per fetched bytes, okay? And this measures the traffic between main memory and caches, and it's also sometimes called the arithmetic intensity. Okay, it's a way how to achieve this is you look at your code, right? If we take a simple example where we say A equals B plus C, right? In this example, we have two loads and one store and one arithmetic operation, right? This means that we have one operation, and let's say each element is 4 byte, right? That means that we have 1/12 for the arithmetic intensity for this line of code, right? Okay, and the roofline model is then trying to unify this arithmetic intensity and the memory bandwidth and the maximum achievable computing performance. Okay, how this looks like again is that we can put up a graph where we have the achievable computing performance, which is the minimum of either the peak the peak performance, the peak floating point operations per second, and the intensity times the bandwidth. Okay? The peak memory bandwidth. Okay? So the only thing that we need for this model to work and to apply it is to have a knowledge of how many floating point operations per second our processor is able to do and the peak memory bandwidth. Okay. And that's all. Right. And this is approximately how it looks like. Right. So this line here is the peak computational performance. And this line here is the intensity times peak bandwidth. Right, and they eventually cross, so that's why it's called roofline. Right, it somehow looks like a roof, and right. So this is the characteristical curve of your architecture. Then, if you have some application and calculate the operational intensity, right. In this case, we have 1/12, right, which is kind of bad. It's somewhere here. If we have more sensible codes, we might get an operational intensity. So in this example, we might get an operational intensity of 2 for our application, right? And if we draw a straight line up, we can see that we are in the region where we are bound by the memory system, okay? And if we increase the operational intensity, that means that we do more floating point operations per loaded bytes. We essentially end up in the compute bound section. Okay. If we have a architecture that's built precisely for our system, we would end up at exactly this knee point here, right? Because then everything's balanced. The memory subsystem is, so we don't waste any resources. If we are here, we could do more, we could theoretically load more memory. If we are here, we essentially waste our computational capacity, right? So if we end up here, we can reduce the bandwidth of our memory system. If we end up here, we can reduce the frequency or something of our system, right? So very, very easy. Okay. So far, so good. In general, what you need to do in order to get this characteristic curve is that you determine the peak memory performance with a benchmark program, right? Where you can either use the so-called stream benchmark or the liquid toolset to get the peak memory bandwidth performance. In order to get the peak compute performance, well, you just look at your specification of the processor and look at the frequency that you have, look at the instructions that you have. So, for example, for this 64-byte vector instruction thingy, I can do 16 floating point operations per cycle, theoretically, right? And multiply it by the by the frequency, and then you get the gigaflops per second, right? And then you can draw the curve. Then multiply it by the number of cores that you have on your system, and you get the full full speed. Okay. What this simple model doesn't account for is that once you have a multi-core system, you don't account for all the traffic and all the sharing between the cores, which will happen in real applications, but it's still a good enough approximation. Okay. So, right. So, what you can do once you have your application, once you identified the operational intensity of your application, and put it into the roofline model and look at it, what you can immediately derive from it is what to do next in order to optimize your application, right? So we could either add ceilings to the roofline, so get higher or lower by applying instruction level parallelism and vectorization, by trying to exploit an equal number of floating point additions and multiplications. Restructure loops for unit strides memory exits. So this is for the compute bound side. This is for the memory bound side, right? And what it looks like is when we have those curves here, right? When we look at it, a single core machine, right? Where we have no task level parallelism. If we add multiple cores to the mix, we get more computational power, right? And if we then add instruction level parallelism, we get even more computational power. But what you can also see is that you have to work harder on the application side to get more flops per byte, because this knee point moves to the moves more and more to the right. Okay. But the message here is, if you have an application and you measure the performance of your application, put it into the roofline model, and you have, say, arithmetic intensity of 2, right? You measure the performance and you end up at, I don't know, 0.6, whatever, something around here, right? You know that, oh, okay, if I add task level parallelism, if I add multiple cores, I might end up here, right? So this is where to apply the optimizations, right? And then, oh, I didn't exploit all the instruction level parallelism, so I could end up here, right? So this gives you a hint of where to look next to optimize the code, right? Okay. So here you, here you see the example of a oldish Barcelona AMD Opteron processor, where you have no instruction level parallelism, right? And if you add the instruction level parallelism, you push up the ceiling of your computational performance, right? If you add vectorization, you even can push the limits a little bit higher. Okay, okay. So that's the basic idea, right? So right. So this is the example of how to increase the instruction level parallelism, right? If we just have this simple for loop where we sum up the vector elements with the scalar, right? Which is the perfect load balances for the fuse, for the multiplications and additions, right? And we can then unfold the loop. So write it in such a way that we seem to perform two operations in parallel or four operations in parallel, right? And we can increase this instruction level parallelism by introducing more than one accumulation variable here, right? Because then each instruction is completely independent of each other.
Yeah, but if we do it like this, we have to make sure that I is dividable by two or four.
Yeah. No. That's always the problem.
If I isn't divided by two or four, do we add the last step after the for loop, or is it better to just go with the normal sum without loop unraveling?
At the last steps with a simple loop then. So you usually do for the number of elements that are divisible in this example by four, and then do the rest with the regular loop here, because that's usually only two or three elements, right?
Oh, yes.
No. Okay. The other thing is, instead of doing the scalar operations, right, you can also add the vector instructions here, which will give you, so this is for single precision, this is scalar multiplication, scalar addition, and this is the parallel addition, right? So where you get another speed up again by explicitly writing it like this, right? So you just push the ceiling up a little bit, okay? And the same things can be applied to the bandwidth line, right? So if you have a multi-socket system, the multi-socket systems are usually classified as NUMA systems. NUMA stands for non-uniform memory access. Okay, that means that the if you access memory, the access times are not always the same. So if you don't look out for that, it might be that you just pay a lot of latency and have a have an additional bandwidth limitation. And if you account for it, you can push the maximum bandwidth ceiling a little bit. If you add prefetching or some cache optimizations, you can utilize the cache more effectively, right? So you can just push the bandwidth into the upper left corner with certain techniques, right? Right, and this is to illustrate the impact of the usage of the cache, right? If you have an application with a specific amount of with a specific value for the arithmetic intensity, right? And you don't program with the caches in mind. Well, if you have all three C's, all three cache misses, right? You end up being way more bandwidth limited if you only have in comparison to once you only have compulsory misses, right? Because if you only have compulsory misses, then you don't really load from main memory, right? But you load from the cache, which is usually way faster, right? This means that assuming that B and C is in the cache, right? We only need to store A. That means we can we then have 1/4 for the arithmetic intensity for this example, okay? Right. There's also a very nice paper, an insight visual performance model for multi-core architecture, which introduces the roofline model, and which has all those tables again into this. It's not very readable, of course. So let me open up this article. Dum-dum-dum-dum. Where will it pop up? So very long articles. There's a lot to learn. Why doesn't it have the pictures? I'm missing the pictures. There we go. This is one example of the of applying the roofline model for five different applications to a specific architecture, right? Where we have a sparse matrix vector multiplication, a stencil application, a lattice Boltzmann application, two fast Fourier transforms with different sizes, and we are able to see where in the roofline model we are, right? So the sparse matrix vector multiplication has a arithmetic intensity of 1/4, right? And the further we move to the right, the higher the arithmetic intensity gets. And the crosses here are what has been measured on the specific system, right? And you can immediately see in which regions you end up, right? And the article then very nicely explains what can be done and what could be done to the specific applications in order to improve it a little bit more. Okay. All right. So this is with the this is again the roofline, this time for the Intel Xeon Clovertown processor, and here you see the different the different ceilings for the computational bound, right, where you have only multi-core, add instruction level parallelism, add vectorization, balance, multiply, and additions, right? And you see that the ceiling is being pushed up and up and up, right? So if you do not account for all this parallelization possibilities on your core, you might end up, as with the lattice Boltzmann, on exactly the ceiling here. So you say, oh, all good, all nice. But you actually could do better, right? If you add all the different things, and for the lattice Boltzmann case, where you first ended up as computational bound, if you push the ceiling, you actually have to work harder to get to the peak floating point performance. Okay. Questions? The roofline model will be covered in detail in the exercises as well.